Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we will be continuing with the Bhagavata Vahini. In fact, today can be considered as a mini opening to a Bhagavatam, because that is what happens where Vyasa starts relating some stories to Raja Parikshit. It is going to be a very interesting session, because I think one thing that we will very clearly learn in this satsang segment is how one should have intensity of craving, pining and devotion to one's Lord. And we will learn that from Raja Parikshit himself. Apart from that, we will also be seeing an amazing remedy in order to ease this craving and pining that we get for Swami. Many times it happens that, you know, we miss Swami, we crave for Him, we pine for Him. That's why it becomes so easy for us to identify with Raja Parikshit, because he was in a very similar situation like all of us today. And what should we do when we crave and miss Swami, crave for Swami, miss Him? That solution also, I think, gets highlighted in today's afternoon satsang segment. So a lot will be happening, it will be very interesting. And on behalf of both Prem and myself, I offer my most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet and welcome all our listeners to today's satsang. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind. Yes, you know, it is indeed an opening to the rest of the stories which will follow in the Bhagavatam, but you know, it also speaks of a very important point which we should not miss. Because many times when we talk about Parikshit, we always refer to him as the person who converted a curse into a blessing, right? You know, that's the best way of looking at him, because that's the story we will come to. But that quality or that ability to convert a curse into a blessing does not come overnight, right? Mm. This is the part where Swami gives a lot of emphasis to explain about the nature of Parikshit, which led him to do what he did when he got the curse. And as often as Swami would say it, you know, it is important to remember that. But Swami would tell that to be able to call God when you are in a moment of crisis, or when you are about to depart from this worldly, you know, physical frame, you need to have practiced that when you did not have the crisis, right? And that is what this part of the story actually speaks of. And I mean, just a couple of days back, I was listening. Our, you know, the hostel in Prashanthi Nilam keeps uploading these beautiful interviews of some of the students and lecturers, mm-hmm. some gems of interviews which are there. I think if our listeners have not heard that, they should go to YouTube and try to look out for that.
I think the channel is called Students of Psy.
Students of Psy.
And right. Under that channel, they have got so many interviews, dozens of interviews of different students, alumni
mostly.
And teachers.
Teachers.
And as you said, real beautiful experiences, pearls of wisdom. So dear listeners, this is definitely a treasure, a secret we are revealing to you. If it is a secret to you, please go to YouTube and check on the channel Students of Psy and enjoy hours and hours of satsang of a great variety.
Right, absolutely. And more than satsang is the learning. And in fact, the latest one which I heard there, and which was very apt to what we're talking about now,
mm-hmm.
two aspects of the story. It is the interview of Professor Chandrasekhar, right? We call him Dr. Chase.
That's how he likes to be called.
Right, and a very, very friendly person, very sweet person. He was talking about an incident which happened when he was living in Australia, when he and his wife actually had gone to a concert,
mm-hmm.
what we call, what in South we call as Arangetram, you know, when your child learns, especially Bharatanatyam or something.
And graduates.
Right, graduates to the state where you can give a stage performance. The first stage performance is referred to as an Arangetram. So they were attending the Arangetram of one of their friend's child, right? So that's where they were, and suddenly his wife started complaining that, I'm feeling very stuffy, I'm not able to breathe,
mm-hmm.
I'm feeling breathless, and I'm feeling giddy. So he thought, maybe the auditorium is very packed, we'll have to step out for a while and you can breathe. But even as he was telling this, he saw that his, you know, wife put her head back. She fell on the couch where she was sitting, limp, and there was no movement. You know, eyes closed, mouth was wide open. I mean, eyes did not close. Eyes were wide open, mouth was wide open, but there was no movement. And immediately he checked the pulse and he found that she had actually passed away.
Oh my God.
And I mean, he didn't know what to do. He was completely blank. And then, of course, the other people bring her down and they call 911 and they get the ambulance help and all of that. But eventually, I mean, that part we'll probably leave it for a little more later, where the beautiful incident which he narrates in relation to that. But one thing what he says then was, he was a devotee, he was involved in the activities of the Samiti, he used to do a lot of seva, he had come all the way to India to spend some time with Swami and attend the Shivratri celebrations. He said, but at that moment, which is probably the most critical time that he had faced in a long time in his life, he said, I didn't think of Swami. I went completely blank and I couldn't even pray to Swami, I didn't even take Swami's name once. And he says, when I look back, now I realize why it is so important to constantly think of God, constantly yearn for God, constantly keep Swami in your thoughts. Because without that, the worst crisis can come to you and you will not call God if you have not practiced that. And this phase of Parikshit's life, which we're going to talk about today, is testimony to that fact that he so spontaneously did what he did after he got the curse, because his nature was to always yearn and pine for Krishna.
The part of the story that Bhagwan also describes, I think, is also the part before he actually got the curse, because Swami is describing in detail about his rule and about how Parikshit was the ideal ruler. Now, from the episode that you narrated, that you left halfway, and I think you should reveal the suspense at around 1:45, just before 2, so that people listen to the whole afternoon satsang. Okay, so
maybe they'll switch off the afternoon satsang and go to the YouTube channel. It's quite possible, I guess.
Yeah, that might also happen. Anyway, when you narrated that, what struck me was, as Professor Chase rightly said, it was so difficult to remember Swami in times of such intense distress. Imagine if we find it hard to remember Swami in times of such intense distress, when we think that is the most natural thing to do. If I'm in distress, I'll call out to Swami. How much more harder it will be to think of Swami in moments of joy? And because in distress, at least there is a selfish element there. Like, I want help. I want help, and if God is one among those from whom I wish to seek help, I will definitely remember him. But in times of pleasure, I feel on top of the world. I don't need anything else. I'm already having everything. That's how I feel. In such situations, how difficult it is to remember God. The greatness of Parikshit is that in such scenario, when everything is fine, he has not yet received the curse, the kingdom is prosperous, everybody is singing lavish praises on him, everybody is happy with him, the sages, the saints, you know, you can't ask for a situation better than this in your life. In such a situation, Parikshit is not happy because he's thirsting for Lord Krishna, he's thirsting for divinity, he's thirsting for God. That is a great tribute to Parikshit, I feel, because even in times of distress, we may manage to remember God. But to remember God in times of joy, in times of prosperity, in times of plenty, when everything is going right.
I mean, actually, what you said is a graduation. It's easy to remember God in the times of distress, that we always do, what Swami would say, you know, Sankatam Aste Venkata Ramana, Swami would say. That is easy. It's actually also easy to think of God when you're extremely happy or something, you've landed a huge fortune. You know, something extraordinary happens in our life, we say, oh, thank you, Swami, you know, such a beautiful thing. You know, you land a job which gives you a bigger salary than you expected, or, you know, at a moment of childbirth or something like that. You know, it's very easy to think of Swami, but it's even more difficult to think of Swami, as you said, at moments when there is calm, there is prosperity, and there is no spike in any excitement.
No spike or fall.
Right. At that time, to think of Swami is very difficult. And I think that is the time when we have to practice. And any times when I hear this bhajan which Swami sings, Prema Mudita Manase Kaho, we understand that we have to think of God with love, and we also understand that we have to think of the name Rama. But actually the working word in that whole sentence is the word mudita, which we usually don't define. Because mudita, if you actually go into the meaning, it means when you feel happy when you actually don't have a reason to feel happy. Right? Mm-hmm. It often refers to the quality which Swami would say that we all have to develop. Like if something good is happening in your life, there is nothing I'm going to gain by the good that is happening in your life, but I feel happiness for you. Swami would say that quality is called mudita. When you genuinely feel happy when something good happens to another person, Swami would say that with that quality of mudita, can you think of God? There is nothing special happening to me, there is nothing grand I'm achieving today, but still I'm happy with an prema mudita, you know, overflowing love, you're thinking of God.
And when people watch a person who is actually living the mudita, you wonder why on earth is he happy? How on earth is he happy? Right. That is how actually Swami defined, you know, to Brother Sanjay Mahalingam, he was narrating how Swami once asked him in an interview, the difference between happiness and bliss. And for those of us who know Sanjay Mahalingam, we know that he is very well read into everything, the Upanishads, the Vedas. He's got a lot of knowledge, and he tried his best to define, you know, the difference between happiness and bliss. You know, bliss is permanent, happiness is temporary, all these things. But Swami was not satisfied, and Sanjay himself was not satisfied, because he knew that none of this is a perfect answer. It's not just clinching it. Finally, Swami gave the answer in one sentence, so beautifully, so sweet. And I think that is the most concise and perfect definition of bliss versus happiness. Swami said, causeless happiness is bliss. So simple. If you are feeling happy, ask yourself why you are feeling happy. If you found a reason for that happiness, rest assured it's not bliss. Because it is based on some cause. And once that cause disappears, the happiness also will disappear. Therefore, when you are happy and you ask, why am I happy, and I don't know, I'm just happy, then that is bliss. Because that, like as you said, that is mudita. Mudita is, I don't need anything, any reason to be happy. I'm just happy, possibly because it's my nature to be happy. So, I was just reminded of this episode when you were defining mudita.
Absolutely. So that is why I think as devotees, at random times you have to start thinking of Swami. You know, when you wake up after a good night's sleep, can you say, oh Swami, I had a wonderful sleep last night. Or something absolutely, you know, normal, that when your digestion is good, can you think of Swami? And you know, when you, people would say that when, you know, Swami writes in that beautiful poem, when you take that sip of water, when you're absolutely thirsty, can you think of me? When it's so dry and parched, and when there is that first smell of rain, can you think of me? Because all of these times is when you make it a habit to think of Swami. And finally, when you come to the point when you're in a crisis, when you actually don't think, right? What they would often say is, your response becomes muscle memory. Sometimes they say that when it comes to sports. Hmm. That you actually don't think and react, but it becomes muscle memory that you automatically react.
Because of the training.
Because of the training over a period of time. And that is precisely what we have to do. And that's wonderfully what Parikshit has done, as we will see today.
I think last week we were talking about how King Parikshit would spend a lot of his time reliving the memories and the glories of his grand uncles with Bhagwan Krishna, with Lord Krishna. Because he felt that the way they led their life, the way Krishna solved the problems, the advice that Lord Krishna gave, these moments of advice and these incidents were not relevant only for those times. They are relevant forever. Because anything that is associated with the Lord is eternal. That is the reason why, you know, we need not actually technically mourn that Swami is physically not with us, because everything that Bhagwan has given us is eternal, because it has come from eternity, it will stay till eternity. So it's not like we have come late or we missed something or we have lost something. It's always available if only we choose to seek it. Let's face it, when Bhagwan was physically available also, if we did not choose to seek Bhagwan, there would be no use. And this day and age, when Bhagwan is physically not available, those who have sought Bhagwan have found him in their own unique special ways. So what becomes very clear is seeking God is the most important thing. We have to seek. How he answers to us is left to him, and let us rest assured that he will do his job perfectly. We just have to do our seeking perfectly. And that is what Parikshit was doing. That is what we saw in the last satsang. How he would be happy with dramas and plays that were based on the life of the Pandavas and Krishna. That is why many people also came forward to put up such things. All the cultural programs were themed about Lord Krishna. See, this also shows the importance of the ruler, you know, of be it the prime minister, the president. The emphasis that they lay on personally in their life somehow or the other influences the fortune of the country. And I think being in India or being in any other country, one would have observed it, that yatha raja tata praja. India is not a kingdom, of course. India is having a democratically elected person to head the country. But even if we take that person as the raja, as the ruler, we can see how our nation's fortunes have fluctuated with the standing, with the character, with the nobility of the person that we have elected to lead the country. So, though the way of ruling the country has changed from a kingdom to a democracy, the age-old dictum of yatha raja tatha praja never changes. It very largely depends on the person on top. And here, when Parikshit was the raja, the person on top, he was so influenced and moved by Lord Krishna. It is natural that his entire kingdom, which spanned a large geographical area, would be in touch with divinity, would be influenced by the same Lord Krishna.
Absolutely. And he was not, as we saw last week, he was not just a ruler, but he was an emperor, what we refer to in ancient history as Chakravarti, you know, where after you perform the Ashwamedha Yajna, you actually become a superior ruler over the vassal kings.
A suzerain, a king of kings.
Right, a king of kings in that sense. And Swami writes that he was not interested in the prosperity which comes out of a position like that. You know, he would often gather all of these kings, he would go to their kingdoms, and he would say that, you know, this is what I want from you. I want that you should establish dharma in your own kingdom, and you should propagate the worship of Krishna, or the worship of Krishna which would lead to righteous living. So he ensured that his supremacy over the rulers would lead to this, rather than him getting more richer or him receiving. He would say that, I don't even want the taxes which you should actually pay me because I am supreme to you. But you ensured this, and if this is not achieved, be sure that I will come hard on you. And that's what we saw last week.
He came hard upon those who were not in alignment with these lofty principles. One more interesting thing to note here is, you know, when you are sincerely seeking God, somehow or the other, everything that you meet in life gets you God. So Parikshit was not in the physical presence of Lord Krishna, but whatever he did, wherever he went, he actually enjoyed the omnipresence of Lord Krishna. That is what we will see. For example, in one of the tours, an old man comes up to him, you know, with tears of joy rolling from his eyes, and just seeing him, Parikshit is overcome. And he asks him, what is it, sir, what can I do for you? You know, I can perceive that tejas, that effulgence from you. And that old man starts speaking. He says, you know, it has been my great blessing that I got this opportunity to officiate in the Ashwamedha Yajna that your grand uncles performed, particularly Yudhishthira. And in that Ashwamedha Yajna, I was one of the chief officiating priests. And he says that, seeing you, I am feeling like sharing this episode which is the greatest treasure of my life. And thus he begins to narrate a very beautiful incident, a personal experience of his from the Ashwamedha Yajna times to Raja Parikshit.
Right. And he goes on to say, in fact, he is not able to complete his narration, because even as he starts speaking, he chokes and he says, I can't even recollect that and narrate it to you, because it was such a blasphemous thing that we allowed to occur. Mm-hmm. Then Parikshit, you know, is all the more curious. He said, no, you will have to tell me what it is. And he starts pleading with him. And Swami beautifully describes, immediately Parikshit removes his upper cloth, which is, of course, must have been a very expensive cloth. He puts it down. He asks the Brahmin to sit down, and he also sits down and says, you know, please narrate to me what from that experience, what you underwent. So then the Ritvik says about the role that Krishna played during that yajna. He says that Krishna, the Lord of all lords, he sat down, in front of him was a golden plate, And he made each one of us come to him, place our feet in that golden plate, and he washed our feet and he sprinkled that water on himself.
In fact, you know, so overwhelmed is this old person recollecting this, and we can very much empathize with him, because, you know, when we recollect of some moments with Bhagwan where we know that, you know, what Bhagwan has done to us is not possible of replication in ages, in lifetimes to come. That is the way he has touched our heart. That is the way he has done so many things beautifully for us. Many times it happens that when we recollect that and we are narrating, midway we just choke and, you know, we are not able to complete it. That's what happens to this person. What happens is he says that I was seated there, we had no idea there was a golden plate placed in front of us. We were supposed to put our feet in it. And I did it, and then he just chokes. He's not able to tell anything, and he says, no, I can't say it, I can't even say it, because he's feeling so terribly embarrassed. But this only builds on the curiosity of Raja Parikshit. He says, no, tell me what happened, what happened? He says, Lord Krishna, you know, he came with a golden jar in his hand, and again he breaks down. And Parikshit is simply, you know, is so caught in the suspense, and he says, no, tell me what next? And he says, no, with his divine hands, with his lotus hands, he cleaned our feet. And he cleaned our feet, and, you know, I don't know what to say. Just imagine, Prem, if Swami were to clean our feet. I've heard of this episode when Sanjay Sahni sir was narrating it, as to how, you know, when Atal Bihari Vajpayee, the former Prime Minister of India, He is a brahmachari, he never married throughout life, was celibate throughout life, and Swami has spoken highly of him on many occasions, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee has come to Swami many times, even before he became the Prime Minister. He had come at a time when his party had just 2 seats in the 560 odd seat parliament that we have. And it was at that time Swami had told him that you will become a prime minister. And I think he must have laughed at it in his mind, because how is it possible? You know, where is 2 seats? Where is 560 seats? But he indeed became prime minister, and it is credit to him that even after being the prime minister, he was the same humble self. Possibly one moment when he forgot this was because of a severe knee pain that he suffered from. When Atal Bihari Vajpayee had come to Vrindavan, a chair had been placed for him when Swami called him for an interview. And Vajpayee ji went and sat on that chair, because that is what he thought it was. And he could not sit on the floor because his knees were giving him trouble. Sahni sir was narrating how he heard from the person present in the interview room there what Swami said. You know, it's very shocking, because it transcends all these boundaries of position, power, everything. Because Swami walks in and says, Vajpayee, ye tumhara prime minister ki gadi nahi hai. This is not your prime ministerial chair. And Vajpayee immediately jumps up from the chair, pushes the chair, sits on the floor, though it is paining his knees. He just sits saying, correct Swami, I made a mistake, forgive me. The next thing that happens is so beautiful. Swami also doesn't sit on his chair. Swami also sits beside Vajpayee on the floor. And I remember, you know, as Sahni sir is narrating it itself, he became emotional. He said, Swami began to massage his knees. Massage the knees of Vajpayee and say, Vajpayee, this is paining, I know it will go. You know, what an overwhelming experience it must have been for that devotee. Now we can imagine how it is for this priest here, because, you know, thinking in the worldly sense, at least he had a knee pain and Swami was removing the pain. Here you're hale and hearty and fine and Swami is washing your feet. That is what Krishna did, and did not stop at that. The silk cloth that he had on his shoulder, the regal cloth, the royal cloth, with that he is wiping their feet dry. And this Brahmin is so embarrassed. What happens in such moments is, it is possible that we forget who is in front of us, you know. Because Swami behaves like us, Swami speaks like us, Swami does everything like us, we may for a moment forget who he is. And that could have possibly happened to many Brahmins. But this Brahmin says that at the end of the Yajna, you know, at the end of the Yajna, when the Purnahuti had to be received, who was there receiving all the oblations? Lord Krishna, and we all were blessed to have that darshan of that Virata Swarupa. Lord Krishna revealing himself in his true form, true glory, and the Brahmin says it is so overwhelming to think of that Lord. He humbled himself so much. In the Bible it is said, he that humbleth himself will be exalted. It is natural that the Lord is the most exalted because the Lord is the most humble. And it is with lot of emotion and love and joy that the priest recollects this beautiful episode wherein Krishna washed their feet and at the end of the yajna granted them the greatest vision that one could ever pine for or seek.
Right. And you know, even as he was narrating that, I wonder if the embarrassment was there when it was happening really. You know, the feeling of embarrassment probably would have come after getting the vision, when you realize that who was the Lord who actually washed my feet.
Mm.
You know, many times it happens like that. It reminds me of what one of the devotees once shared. I don't know which yajnam he was referring to, whether it was the Dashara yajnam. Mm. But he said that it was one which he was there part of, and he was, you know, with Swami assisting in the functioning, in the whole yajnam as it was. So he said the yajnam was going on. Most of the Rithiks who had come were all, had come for the first time to Puttaparthi. And they had this feeling that, you know, they were invited to perform this yajnam because they were more qualified. And, you know, here was Swami, who was probably some good man, who was doing some good work. So they did not really give that kind of respect which Swami deserved. But Swami was absolutely cool about it. You know, he was not making a fuss about it as much as the devotees around were. But he was saying that first day Swami, the yajna went on, nothing happened. The second and third day, Swami started walking around, and Swami would stop at, you know, the place where there was a young Rithvik here and there who was probably chanting it very casually. And Swami would stop and say, you know, what did you just chant? Chant it again. And then Swami would correct it. So after that, you know, they said, oh, you know, he's not just an ordinary person. He seems to have some knowledge.
Right?
He knows what he is asking us to do. So they became a little more careful and a little more respect came in. But he said what was beautiful was, you know, towards the end of the yajnam, on the day of the Purnahuti, everything was being done. And, you know, Swami also materialized those gemstones and he put it inside. But still, some of the Rithviks, especially the main person, was not very impressed. So he decided to, you know, play a little stiff on that day.
Mm.
Swami asked him that, have you offered everything that you have to offer? Is there anything more you need to offer? So this person apparently told Swami that, Swami, yes, whatever we can offer, we can offer. We've offered. But according to the scriptures, of course, they say that the most supreme offering to be made to the fire is the Parijata flower. Right? But of course, where can we get the Parijata flower from? Because according to legend, it is the flower which grows in heaven. We know the story of Satyabhama and Krishna where, you know, he eventually brings the Parijata tree because Satyabhama gets upset.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think Rukmini gets
correct.
The flower, right? That's the
correct.
Legend. So this Rithvik apparently said that, Swami, Parijata flower has to be offered, right? And Swami said, oh, Parijata flower, yeah, we can offer that, right?
Mm.
And even as all these people could get to terms with what they were hearing from Swami, apparently Swami waved his hand and materialized a flower which none of them had seen, right? And even though this was happening in the Purnachandra Hall, or what was then before the Purnachandra Hall in that place,
mm-hmm.
he said the people sitting in the audience could not see what Swami had materialized, you know, because they were all sitting far away, but they could get the fragrance of what Swami had materialized.
My God.
Because it was so very strong and it was absolutely ethereal. And Swami materialized that flower very nonchalantly, and Swami said, and gave it to the Rithvik and said, yeah, you can offer this. The next moment, all of them fell flat at Swami's feet. They knew that what they saw was completely beyond, you know, anything they could comprehend. So, I mean, that's precisely what would have happened to the Rithviks there. Maybe they understood the divinity of Krishna then, but they would have certainly understood the divinity of Krishna on the last day when he gave them the vision of who he really was.
Perfect. And as this Rithvik narrates this to Parikshit, Parikshit is also so overwhelmed. That is the beauty of divine experiences, you know. They transmit to even to the listener. We might not have experienced any of those things in our life, but as we hear them being narrated, we also undergo that experience. That is the beauty, and we should be grateful to Swami for endowing his stories with that property. Because if not for that property, what hope we would have. So, offering our gratitude to Swami for this beautiful ability of his stories to thrill and, you know, evoke devotion and evoke love for years and centuries to come, I think we will take a little break. On the other side of the break, we will continue with the tour of Raja Parikshit that he's doing of the entire kingdom and his many other interesting incidents that happen after that.
ಶಿತಾನೇಕ ಯೋಗೀಶ ಬೃಂದ ದಯಾಪಾಂಗ ಸಂತೋಷಿತಾನಂದ ದಾಶಾಂತರಂಗ ಸಾಲೋಕ್ಯ ಮಿಪ್ಪಿಂಚುಮ ಸಾಯುಜ್ಯ ಮುನ್ಕೂರ್ಚುಮ ಸ್ವಾಮಿ ಶ್ರೀ ಸತ್ಯನಾರಾಯಣ ಸೋಕಿನ ವೇಣು ಮಧುರಂ
madhuram madhuram ajaram madhuram ajaramu sohina venu madhuram namam madhuram rupam madhuram pilupe madhuram talape madhuram
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just were speaking about a beautiful interaction between an old Ritvik and Raja Parikshit. In this manner, he's on tour of the entire Indian continent, subcontinent. He sees and hears about the rule of the Pandavas. He's thrilled with it. And he meets so many people. Among the different people he meets, one is a very, very, very special personality he comes face to face with. And that is Maharshi Vedavyasa. And Vedavyasa, we know he's the author of the Mahabharata. I don't know, Prem, I mean, this doubt often comes to me. Did Vedavyasa write the Mahabharata live, or did he write it after it has happened, or did he write it before it took place? Because for the Ramayana, it's almost like a live commentary, it feels like. So I was searching on this, and most of the answers that I found online seem to suggest that Vedavyasa wrote the Mahabharata after it happened, you know, that's how it is said. But anyway, Vedavyasa, since he is the author of the Mahabharata, the epic which is considered as the Panchama Veda, the fifth Veda in itself, because of the amount of message it has, the number of, you know, so many unique things about the Mahabharata. I don't know if we have gone through it before, but one thing that really strikes me is not even a single character in the Mahabharata is born in a normal way, if we look at it. Every character has a unique birth. And there are no black or white characters in the Mahabharata. Possibly the only white character is Krishna, because he's the Lord, he's beyond blemish and he's beyond the mind. But every other character in the Mahabharata has shades of grey. You know, you can't say somebody is a hero and somebody is a villain. Everybody is hero, and that is possibly the reason why the Mahabharata is so relevant even to this day. Because even now in the world, we don't know who are, you know, who can be classified as white or black. All of us have our weaknesses, all of us have our strengths, and that's why the Mahabharata becomes a phenomenal text to look up to. Now, the author of the Mahabharata, who better than him to narrate the incidents and episodes from the life of the Pandavas and Bhagwan Krishna? And therefore, when Parikshit comes face to face with Vedavyasa, he falls at his feet, and his heart, his heart's joy knows no bounds, because he feels that he has hit the treasure trove now. And that is what he requests from the Maharshi as well.
So, before we go into what Vedavyasa actually shares with Parikshit, you know, the beautiful stories which Parikshit asks for and he shares, you know, this point which Swami is making is very important, where he says, you know, he goes around the whole country. He constantly keeps bumping into people who tell him about Krishna. The example which Swami gives is that of the Ritvik. Mm. Swami says there are so many people who come to him and tell that, you know, this is literally our tryst with divinity, you know, to give a plug for our program which we have on the radio. They all share the thing, and, you know, what Swami is referring to, in my opinion, is, you know, the ability of you having to come in contact with the stories of the Lord when you are living in a place which is filled with his stories. And I think that is the beauty of, you know, the joy of living in Puttaparthi or visiting Prashantanilayam too. When you come here, you know, what is the chance, every time I think of it, what is the chance of you and I being here or anybody being in Prashantanilayam at any given point of time? Now, especially it hits you when probably you're flying across the oceans or when you're traveling abroad. When you suddenly realize that there are so many people in this world, there are so many countries, the earth is so vast, and as Swami would say, it's a pinprick of a pinprick what Puttaparthi is. To be here in a place where it is suffused with Swami's memories. You walk down the main road of Puttaparthi, you know that 100,000 times Swami has driven past that place. Mm. Every building has been visited by Swami. The place where we are sitting has been visited by Swami. Now, if you come to Puttaparthi, If you have the chance to stay for here for a few days, few months, few years, you know, how important it is to fill that period that you're here with memories of Swami, rather than going after so many other things. There are enough distractions in Prashanthi Nilayam, right?
Absolutely. You
know, to be lost in those distractions and not to be able to stick to Swami's memories, how very unfortunate it would be. I think it's so important. That is why it is important to visit Puttaparthi every now and then, because this place is filled with memories. And that is why it's more important when you visit it to ensure that you fill your time when you spend here with those memories rather than with the distractions which are there on offer.
I think Bhagwan has, you know, done a beautiful thing in trying to keep Prashanthi Nilayam as distraction free as possible.
Right.
Like
we have our ways.
Yeah, the mind has its ways of, you know, finding and seeking. And I speak of that as a positive trait also, because if our mind truly seeks Swami, then in the hottest of deserts, in the most worst of situations, also we can find Swami. But if our mind hankers after, say, visiting the shopping stores which offers everything at a discount of 15% to 20% compared to any other mall or stores outside, and I'm sure that we know of people, or we have also at times got attracted to that more than what is there, what Prashanthi has got to offer. So if we are, you know, it's like Prashanthi is there. Am I here for the whole package to take that Prashanthi? If in that I go searching for, there is Ashanti in Prashanthi, you know. Actually, if you see the word, there is Ashanti in Prashanthi. But if I'm not able to see the whole picture, I will see only Ashanti. And say, what you're speaking of Prashanthi Nilayam, there is Ashanti in Prashanthi. See there. Spelling is P-R-A-S-H-A-N-T-I. A-S-H-A-N-T-I is there. Yes, there is Ashanti in Prashanthi if you don't have a holistic vision. But if we have a holistic vision, we will be able to get Prashanthi, because this is the Nilayam, the home of Prashanthi. And as you rightly said, that should be our focus. We should not nitpick, look at, have a narrow mind, look at only things in part, not completely, and then say there is Ashanti, what is the use, it is as good as any other place. It can't be as good as any other place. It has to be the best place, because the avatar chose to walk. There was once a person who had asked me, you know, saying that you have been here with Bhagwan for so long, no? So give me some memorabilia, something. A handkerchief that Bhagwan used, or a matchbox that he touched, a flower that he touched, or possibly, you know, I had a few pieces of that granite,
right,
when they broke the old dais to build the Sai Sannidhi that we have today. So, oh, give me a chip of that, because, you know, that is my memorabilia. I thought for a while, because I didn't have all of those with me, and I just said, believe it or not, go into any part in Prashanthi Nilayam, pick up a handful of sand and take it with you to your country, to your place, because most probably Swami's feet would have touched it. You know, the dust in Prashanthi Nilayam, how many places, if we look at the inauguration schedule that Swami had, every little building, every small corner Swami has inaugurated. It's not like he inaugurated the stores. He inaugurated a section of the stores, multiple sections of the stores. And, you know, like that, every building, everything, it has come up. Even if we let aside the sand and stones, the air in Prashanthi Nilayam, it is the same air that Bhagwan breathes for decades. You know, so I just felt like telling that person that, you know, take any part of Prashanthi Nilayam with you, it's a memorabilia. Pluck a leaf, take a twig, take the sand. Today people do that. When they go to Mathura, they take the sand. Because Krishna walked on these sands, possibly, probably, if you have got the Mathura right. We believe that this is Mathura. 5,000 years ago, this is less than 10 years ago, and we have proof. In fact, if you actually want concrete proof, we have proof of photographs of Swami standing in certain areas. Go to that area and pick up that sand. What better memorabilia? As you rightly said, when we come to Prashanthi, we have to fill ourselves in that Prashanthi of the beautiful memories, the experiences, the incidents that Bhagwan has created. And I think that is the only way we will be actually be able to carry this Prashanthi along with us wherever we go in the world.
You know, I recall a beautiful incident which one of the teachers in Vrindavan once shared, which happened quite in the later years. Maybe we know the Vrindavan hostel, you know, there is that quadrangle, and there are those four beautiful trees, which those towering trees right in the center, right, which actually can be seen even from outside the hostel if you are in the right angle. So apparently one day when Swami came out for darshan, Swami was looking towards the hostel. And Swami looked there and Swami said, hey, what are those trees? Where are those trees? Swami was saying, I can see. So then somebody told Swami that, Swami, this is the the four trees in the quadrangle. So we're saying, oh, those trees, the four trees in the quadrangle, because those were the trees which Swami planted himself, right? You know, he was there, so the whole building came up. So we said, oh, those were saplings when we planted them and the hostel was built. And Swami, they're so tall that I can see them from here. So in that sense, you have no idea, you know, which tree has been planted by Swami, which building has been literally supervised by Swami standing there. And the beauty is, you know, when you talk about this Parikshit thing again, as we're going back to what you said, there's Ashanti and Prashanti. Don't forget that Parikshit has inherited a kingdom as much from the Kauravas as he's inherited it from Pandavas. In fact, he's inherited it from Kauravas more, because they seem to have ruled it for a longer time. You know, Dhritarashtra is supposed to have ruled it for a longer time, and we always go back to that point where Pandavas hardly had the opportunity to rule it as much as they should have. But he always looks at it as a kingdom which has been blessed by Krishna, as a kingdom which has been ruled by his pious grandfathers. And I think that is where the focus comes into point. As you're saying, you know, when you're going through life, you are focusing completely on the Swami aspect of the place rather than the Ashanti aspect or the distractions aspects of the place.
And so when Parikshit comes face to face with Vedavyasa, he just says, you know, he tells Vedavyasa that I am a very, very unlucky soul. You know, the Lord walked here and I missed everything. You know, I have missed everything, and I was blessed with grand uncles who have spent so much time with the Lord, but now I'm unfortunate that I don't even have them. So please help me sanctify my lives. I could not see any of those. At least let me hear that. So please spend some time with me. Share with me the glory of Krishna, the glory of the Pandavas, and bless my life. Help me sanctify my lives by my life by this. And this is how he requests Vedavyasa to narrate the stories, the Bhagavatam related to Krishna, as well as the relationship between his grand uncles and Krishna. Now when Sage Vyasa hears this, he decides that first, let me tell you Parikshit that you are not unlucky. Don't think of yourself as unlucky. You know, the very fact that Parikshit has got such pining for Krishna, that is a great good fortune. In fact, the other day, you know, Brother Ratnakar, who is one of the trustees of the Central Trust, he was narrating a thing that Swami said. He said, Swami was asking, how do you know that you are blessed by Bhagwan? How do you know that you are blessed by Swami? Mm-hmm. And Swami himself gave the answer, and he said, without making any effort, if you are able to think of Swami, know that you are blessed. It is not as if that you have to get an interview, that you have to spend time in Bhagwan's room or whatever, you know, touch his feet 1,000 times. What matters is, spontaneously, effortlessly, are you able to think of Swami? And Parikshit has indeed got that great ability. Effortlessly, spontaneously, in times of grief, in times of joy, in times when there is neither grief nor joy, when it's all stable, when it's in the equilibrium, every time he's thinking of Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. How can he consider himself as unlucky? That is why Vedavyasa decides to dispel this notion from Parikshit's head, and he starts telling Parikshit how lucky he actually is.
And in the process, he actually narrates that incident of how Parikshit gets named. You know, we started the whole Bhagavatam with that, where Parikshit is constantly looking for somebody. He's always having that inquiry in his face, even as an infant. Mm-hmm. Then finally, when he is brought to the arms of Krishna, he fixes his gaze on Krishna and doesn't remove it. And then Vyasa describes that whole scene, you know, how there was a hide and seek between him and Krishna. But all the time, this boy was constantly seeking him. There were hundreds of people in the assembly, but he was not taking his eyes away. He says, finally, your grandfather Sahadeva had to pluck you from Krishna's arm and, you know, give you to the queens, but still you fuss so much, they had to bring you back to Krishna. And he's saying that such was the focus that you had on Krishna.
And interestingly, even when Krishna is trying to escape from him.
Right, even when Krishna is trying to
hide.
Escape, and he says, such was the response from Krishna too. He was so impressed by your constantly seeking him, then eventually, you know, Vyasa says that he even named you. And how fortunate you are more than anybody else. So first stop quit calling yourself unlucky, because there is nobody who is as lucky as you are.
In fact, he says that your name Parikshit, though it was, it was thought of by Yudhishthira, officially you were named by Krishna himself. He fondled you. How much time he spent holding you in his arms, even as you were a child. You know, this is one thing that often I used to hear when I was a student. I used to look at those people who are in their 50s and 60s and think how lucky they are. They have come to Swami, they have spent 30 years with Swami. They are indeed blessed, you know, because 20, 30 years of their life they have spent with Swami. But those very people, when they would speak to us, they would say, you are also lucky. Here is a 60-year-old person telling that you are lucky. And the reason he would give is, you have come to Swami as a child. You know, we came to Swami when we were 30, when we were 40, when we are past the stage when we could be molded, when we are past possibly of our prime. That is when we came to Swami. How does it matter how many years we spent? You have come as tender buds. How lucky you are. In fact, I think, was it Bhagwantam or Gokak who said that if I get an opportunity to take a...
Professor Sampath, okay.
Right. He said that I would like to come back as a student in the university. You know, on the face of it, when you hear such a thing, you'll wonder, why on earth are you asking this? You are the vice chancellor of the university. Swami spends time with you daily, and yet you say you want to come as a student of the university. That's possibly because of this factor, that it is a great blessing to get to know Swami in the early years of your life. The earlier, the better, because that much more time, energy, enthusiasm, and faith you have. Because childhood is a time when faith comes so spontaneously. Once we get into the teens and later on, that's when the questioning attitude comes. And even if we get to know Swami, it'll take us years to actually get to know Swami. Because we lack in faith. And that is why as an infant, when you get to know the Lord, it's a great blessing. And Vyasa tells that is a blessing that was conferred on you. Even as an infant, you got to know Krishna and you won the love of Krishna. And Krishna was fondling you every time. And he in fact named you as Parikshit. So you are a person who tests whether a person is Krishna or not. And if anything that is not Krishna, you are not interested in. Only if it is Krishna, you are interested in. How lucky you are. So please stop calling yourself as unlucky. Now while Vyasa is trying to enlighten him on his great good fortune, Parikshit thinks that possibly this is an excuse Vyasa is making so that he does not narrate about the stories of Krishna and Pandavas. And that's why he puts forth his next sweet arguments to which Vedavyasa melts.
Yes, because Parikshit says that all that you say is fine. But all said and done, it happened when I was unaware of the things which happened to me. You know, he says that even if you take a very, very precious diamond and give it to a child, for the child it's only a ball of glass, and that's how the child will treat it. So in that sense, yes, for you who were noticing that scene which was happening in front of you, witnessing that scene happening in front of you, you were in awe of it because you knew the value of the presence of Krishna. But as an infant, I was not aware of it. If I am aware of it, it's now what I get. I value it. But going back to again Vyasa's argument, I think that's a very, very beautiful message for all of us, because many people now come and ask, what about our children? They ask us, we are not lucky to see Swami. But I think this argument, we need to take it home. We all have the opportunity to create that same environment for the children who come into our lives now, right? To give them that blessing that you came to know Swami from a very early age. But for that, we need to do the environment, building that environment around them. And Swami would say, many people, when they graduate from Swami's university, they get into their jobs, they get so busy, but after they get married and when they get their child, then they realize that, oh God, I have to give them the environment. And then they start going into the Sai centers, and then they start taking the children to Balvikas. But it doesn't really work like that. Again, going back to what we started with, when the weather is good, you need to do what you have to do. You can't build your roof when it's raining, right? So you need to start early. That's what the opportunity to give that to every child which is being born now is within our reach, to be able to give them the Lord when they are young and to help them grow with the Lord, which we did not have.
And even as we are trying to impart this to the children, it's so important that we are also convinced of it, If we are hypocrites, we are just trying to tell them, you're lucky, you get to know Swami, you do prayer. But unless we are convinced, it will not have its impact. Because the words that we speak are actually backed by the actions that we do and the conviction that we have. I think that is why Swami would often say, be, do, and then tell. Because when you are being, that is the conviction. When you are doing, that is the action. Action and conviction are very much necessary to back the words that we speak. And therefore, especially when we are speaking to children who are so pure. And I'm saying this because I have a 1.5-year-old child at home, and I really feel that this child is nothing but a part of Swami. And therefore, you can't afford to be a hypocrite. They will see through it easily. The child may not be able to speak and tell you that you're being a hypocrite, but hypocrisy will be seen through very easily because of the purity that a child embodies. And so, as you said, it's an important lesson and message for all of us. And it's also a empowering thought, because one need not feel that we have come late to Bhagwan or we have missed Bhagwan. Our children will not be able to see Bhagwan. And so, going on with the story, when Vyasa tells Parikshit that your fortune is very, very great, and Parikshit replies saying that I was not aware when I was getting it. Now I am aware of it, so I seek more. Vyasa realizes that Parikshit does not actually feel that he is a very unlucky person. He knows that it is love for Krishna in his heart that sanctifies his life. And he seeks more and more of Krishna. So it is this yearning of a seeker that Vyasa perceives. And therefore Vyasa decides to narrate to him whatever his heart wishes to. But then he starts by saying, O Parikshit, where do I begin? You know, I'm reminded of that famous song that goes, where do I begin to tell the story of how sweet a love can be? The sweet love story that is older than the sea. Because that is the love story, the divine romance between us and God. It is older than the sea and it is filled, replete with so many things, you don't know where do you begin. So Vyasa asks Parikshit, where do I begin? And you know, Parikshit, we can very well relate to him, because if we meet somebody new here, what is the first question we ask? How did you meet Swami? How did Swami come into your life? Why did you start loving Swami? How did you get attached to Swami? That's exactly what Parikshit asks Vedavyasa. He says, how did my grand uncles get attached to Krishna? Please tell me this. And after this little break, dear listeners, we will go into the narration that Vyasa enters and tells Parikshit how Lord Krishna got attached to the Pandavas.
The Lord was once asked, what relationship must ours be best described as? That of a master and disciple, replied the Lord. For there is walk the path boldly, so as to not stumble over the people. The truth that Guru is
Hari Ho. मन कर पत हरि दर्शन को आज मन कर पत हरि दर्शन को आज मोरे तुम बिन बिगरे सगरे काज को
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about the conversation which is taking place between Sage Vyasa and Parikshit, where Parikshit is goading Vyasa to share with him more stories about Lord Krishna. He's not satisfied with the story that Vyasa tells him of Parikshit's naming itself. And then when Parikshit asks him to narrate more stories, Vyasa says, you know, it's endless. There is no limit to the kind of leelas that he has done. So if I start, I don't know where to end. I don't know where to begin from. So then Parikshit says that, okay, tell me, how did my grandparents come in contact with Krishna? How did the Pandavas for the first time come in contact with Krishna? And that is when Vyasa starts narrating the incidents which happened during the Swayamvara of Draupadi, because that's the backdrop of the story where Krishna and the Pandavas come in contact with each other.
Again, you know, Draupadi is a character in the Mahabharata who did not have an ordinary birth. She was born out of the sacrificial fire. Raja Drupad, in order to avenge his embarrassment and his insult from Drona, he wants to perform a sacrificial yagna, so that from the yagna he'll be blessed with a son who can actually be the cause of death for Drona. From the same sacrificial fire emerges even Draupadi. So that is the story of the birth of Draupadi. So Draupadi is not like born as a baby and, you know, goes through childhood and has reached. She directly appears as the woman. And when it comes to getting her married, King Drupad actually searches extensively for a hero who is worthy of his daughter, and he doesn't find anybody. And therefore he decides this Swayamvara. You know, Swayamvara is a practice where the woman chooses her own husband. This is very interesting because people often say that the Bharatiya culture is not for the emancipation of women, or, you know, it doesn't stand up for women's rights. It's always male dominated. We never had a marriage where a man goes and picks up his bride, you know, whom he wants to marry. It has always been the other way around. It's always a woman is given the choice and she selects as per her choice. And so in this Swayamvara, the king puts a condition. You know, it was like this in the Swayamvaras. Like how we have an entrance exam where everybody can apply. Definitely all are welcome to apply. But we will interview only those candidates who clear the entrance exam. If you don't clear the entrance exam, you can please go back. So the kings would often do this, and they would hold a contest or something as the first obstacle. Because, you know, when there is a Swayamvara, there will be hundreds of princes, kings, and anybody can come. You know, anybody can come who feels that he is a capable suitor. But in order to make it possibly a little easy for the bride, the king would put up a kind of like how we have an entrance exam, an entrance exam. And what was the entrance exam here? The entrance exam was as follows. The person who wishes to marry Draupadi must have at least this much capability. And what capability is it? There will be a rotating wheel on the ceiling in the Darbar hall, high up on the ceiling. And this wheel will be rotating, and on this rotating wheel, on this contraption, would be the structure of a fish. A fish would be there. And only a person who would be able to shoot at the eye of this moving fish in this contraption could marry Draupadi. But it was not as simple as shooting the eye of the fish also, because one couldn't look directly at the fish. One had to look at the reflection of the fish in a large vessel of water which would be placed right below. And looking at the reflection in the water, one had to shoot at the eye of this fish in order to be, you know, in order to be qualified to marry Draupadi. So this was the Swayamvara rule, that the Swayamvara contest that Raja Drupad had arranged for the Swayamvara of his daughter Draupadi.
And when this was going on, actually the Pandavas were in the forest and were actually incognito, because it was after the episode of the wax palace where, you know, Shakuni plans that to get all the Pandavas burnt by making them stay overnight in a palace which was actually built with wax. and it will be burnt down and the Pandavas will be gutted along with the fire. But Vidura comes to know of it and he actually makes them escape from the thing. And I think the story goes that Vidura wishes that they remain incognito for a while and allow the Kauravas to think that, you know, they've done away with the Pandavas. So it is during this time that this Swayamvara is announced. And they are living in the guise of Brahmins, but it's Arjuna who says that, you know, when somebody puts out a competition like this trying to test the skills of an archer, the archery skills of individuals, he says that it becomes our duty to go forward. I mean, it's something which we owe our guru and it's something which we owe our Kshatriya tradition. So that's when these people end up in the Swayamvara hall, where it is actually filled by the kings who are there to win the hand of Draupadi.
And as these five Brahmins walk in, there is a kind of mixed response from the Darbar hall. Some of them are admiring their audacity and courage to come forward. Some of them are mocking them. Some are wondering who these people are. Some are even suspecting that possibly they are not Brahmins because they are having such powerful bodies and it doesn't look like they are focused only on the development of their brains because their body also is so impressive like any Kshatriya. So a lot of mixed response from the hall. And even as these five Pandavas come and sit in the hall, the Swayamvara hall, Swami writes that Lord Krishna exchanges a few thoughts with Balarama who is by his side. And Swami at that point in time doesn't reveal what is being exchanged. But the two brothers look at the five Brahmins who have arrived and nod. And then the Swayamvara begins. One after another, each king comes forward and tries to shoot the eye of the fish and fails. And naturally so, because Premi, we look at it, it's such a difficult thing. First of all, so tough to just shoot the eye of the bird because the bird is moving. On top of it, to shoot at it while looking at its reflection becomes so much difficult. If the reflection was via a mirror, it would possibly be a little easier. The reflection is through water because, you know, the slightest wind, the slightest breeze, the surface of the water will start rippling, and when the ripples come, the reflection gets distorted. It becomes even more tough. So King Drupad had indeed devised a very, very, very difficult feat. It would almost be like nobody would qualify. So in that scenario, every king who tries one after another fails. And Swami writes that if Krishna so chose, he could have easily gone and shot the eye of the bird. But he decided not to because he knows everything. He knows the story that has unfolded so far. He knows the story that has to unfold. And therefore, knowing the past and the future very well, he behaves with that knowledge in the present. And that's why Krishna abstains from participating in the Swayamvara. That is when one of the Brahmins, naturally Arjuna, steps up and comes forward to do, you know, to participate in the Swayamvara. Needless to say, after a few tense moments where the whole assembly is watching in bated breath, Arjuna releases an arrow with such speed and fury, and it goes straight and strikes the eye of the bird. And, you know, Swami writes that even as Arjuna walks up, everybody is looking at Arjuna, including Draupadi. And possibly Draupadi recognizes, you know, through intuition that this is going to be my husband. And that's why the moment Arjuna shoots the eye of the bird, Draupadi doesn't wait to see if there are any others who qualify. She directly decides that she will be getting married to Arjuna, and that is how Arjuna wins his bride Draupadi, dressed as a Brahmin, and everybody thinks that it is a Brahmin that has won Draupadi.
You know, this whole entire episode of the Swayamvara and Drupada's intention behind the whole Swayamvara, the reason why he actually devises a competition so stiff is the yajna was performed with the idea that he wants a son who will defeat Drona. And that's the whole idea, because that the story goes back to Dronacharya and Drupada being very good friends.
Childhood friends.
And I think there is a deal which is made, which Drupada actually says that, you know, I made it in boyish enthusiasm and you can't ask me to hold on to it. And then Drona becomes very upset. He imprisons him. And who actually does it? I think it's Arjuna who
Arjuna
does it.
It's this. Actually, as Guru Dakshina, Drona asks the Pandavas, asks everybody who can, you know, bring me Drupad to his knees and bring him in front of me. All the Kauravas fail. Arjuna goes and single-handedly does it. And Drupada is brought down to his knees. Emperor Drupada.
Right. It's Arjuna who actually does that. And that is where the source of this idea that I need to get a son who will come and defeat Drona comes. Right. And so he devises this entire Swayamvara with that idea that he'll find an archer who is so supreme as a bridegroom for his daughter, and who will help him achieve this end, and who he ends up finding as his bridegroom is the same Arjuna who was the source of this whole thing, right? So
exactly.
Arjuna himself comes, and probably at that time Drupada thought that, you know, it's a self-defeating thing, because never will I get Arjuna to fight against Dronacharya. He would have never thought that this is possible. But eventually that does happen. They do fight on the opposite sides in the war. And, you know, the Pandavas are responsible eventually for the death of Drupada. And of course his son also is involved in the whole process.
He's actually the final...
The final blow is given by...
Delivered by Drishtadyumna.
But the whole thing is, you know, if you look at it, it cannot be an act of fiction. First of all, you know, that's what it shows. But you know, how many twists and turns are possible in life? You know, you can go through things and you might feel that it's impossible. You know, my dream is not going to happen. I wanted something, it's never going to happen. But it could, there are 100 million possibilities possible. Especially when Krishna comes into the picture, you know, you never know, right, where it is going to have a twist and how you will achieve what you want to achieve. That's why when Swami comes into the picture, your prayer has to be just placed. You know, don't do a GPS tracking of your prayer. No, where is it right now?
Tracking.
Right? You know, that you can do for your online purchases, not for your prayer. Just make your prayer. It will be fulfilled in the form which you initially wanted it, but, you know, don't worry about it every day.
You know, when you were saying about how things pan out in the most unexpected circumstances, in the most unexpected manner, that it is only possible that you look back and think, wow, this happened. You will never be able to imagine it happening at that point in time. I was reminded of a talk that I was seeing. It was a TED talk in which that person was saying about how foolish we are when we envision our future. He was saying, you know, think back at your own life. You know, 10 years ago, what did you think of yourself today? 10 years ago, when we actually think of it, it is very, very different. Honestly speaking, Prem, 10 years back, coincidentally, you know, Prem, this month end, I will be actually completing 10 years at Radio Sai. So it's okay. a fantastic feeling for me. So when I look back at the day when I joined Radio Sai, at that point in time, in no way did I imagine that I would be in the position or the place or whatever I am today. I had a picture of myself, how I would be after 10 years, but that picture is so drastically and dramatically different from what it is today. Because the picture I built of myself 10 years ago was the picture that I was 10 years back, and plus or minus 10 or 15%, you know. That's all it is. We just add on a little more to what our current circumstances and think, this is how my future circumstance will be. And in that TED talk, the person was pointing out to that only. He was saying that you find it dramatically or drastically wrong because 10 years ago, you thought of yourself as yourself 10 years back, plus or minus 10%. And today, what it has happened is so different from that. And that is why you have gone wrong 10 years back. He says, when we do this survey, everybody almost, without exception, at least in certain aspects of their life, they find out they're so dramatically different from what they thought of themselves 10 years ago. But 100% of the people, when you ask them what you will be 10 years from now, they invariably go back to the same formula of considering their present scenario and adding plus or minus 10-15%, you know. That's all. Because you know from your experience that 10 years back what you predicted is totally wrong, and yet we live in the foolish illusion that what we will be 10 years from now will just be about 10-15% different from what we are. That's why, as you said, we have no idea at that point in time. Drupada had no idea that this Arjuna, who can never possibly go against Drona, will actually be responsible for the killing of Drona and fulfilling of his desire, heart's desire. He had no idea. In fact, if we go to the story at this point in time, he didn't even have an idea that it's Arjuna. He just thought it's an amazing archer, a Brahmin. And nobody had an idea. We actually came to the story because Vyasa is narrating how Krishna became attached to the Pandavas. When these Pandavas walk out, when these five Brahmins walk out with the bride, Krishna and Balrama follow them. Because Krishna has whispered precisely this in the ears of Balrama. He says that, I think that these are the Pandava brothers, and I think that the person who shot the arrow is Arjuna. Let's go and ascertain this fact. And that is the reason these two brothers tail the five brothers, and they actually reach the woodcutter's house, or whose house was it that they were staying
Potter's
at?
House,
Potter's house. Potter's house, yes. House. The Potter's house that they were staying at, and that is the time when Krishna actually first time meets all the Pandavas.
Right, and that is where it begins. He introduces himself, and Krishna also says that, you know, when I saw you in the Swayamvara hall, I told Balrama that these must be the Pandavas. And when Arjuna walks up, he says, and that is Arjuna. You know, nobody else would have the guts to walk up and take up this challenge. Mm. So that is how the entire journey starts. And of course, the rest of the story, we will have to keep it for the next time when we meet for the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang.
Possibly just to give a little teaser, you know, it's so sweet. I think we should keep it for next week, because I think we should spend some time into that. Because Krishna's introduction to Arjuna is so sweet, you know, and it sums up the spirit in which Swami introduces himself to us. Krishna says, you don't know me, but I know you. You know, that is how he introduces himself, especially to Arjuna. And this is so significant, and Swami here delves deep into a concept, the concept of Naranarayana, I think, which deserves an entire discussion by itself, and therefore we will not go into it now. We have got another 5-6 minutes before our satsang can come to a close, and Prem, I thought possibly I'll narrate one little episode that happens here which is not there in the Bhagavata Vahini. That is, if Arjuna won the Swayamvara and got Draupadi, how is it that Draupadi married all the five Pandavas? The story goes that these Pandava brothers, they lived as Brahmins, and when you live as Brahmins, you don't think of earning money, because that is left for the business people, the Vaishyas. You don't think of, you know, fighting or anything, or protection or anything else about, you're not bothered about taking care of your land, taking care of, because that is left for the Kshatriyas. As Brahmins, your only job is pursuit of Brahman, pursuit of the ultimate. And therefore, every Brahmin would go around begging, not because they lack in ability, but because they are engaged in far higher pursuits. You know, just like the brain doesn't eat food, right? It's the mouth that eats. And it feeds the brain as well, because the mouth needs the brain. The brain also needs the mouth. Nobody is higher or lower. It's just that they have different functions. That is how the Brahmins would be. They would be lost in the search for Brahman. And therefore, they would go begging. And every day the Pandavas also, because they have put on the vesture of the Brahmin, they would go begging every day. And every day they would return with food and tell their mother, Kunti, who was also staying in this potter's house, saying that, see mother, this is the food that we have brought. And the mother would tell them to divide the food among themselves and have. This day when they return with Draupadi, they tell, mother, look what we have got. This is something very special. And the mother is lost in her prayers. And casually she just says, whatever you have brought, divide it equally amongst yourselves. And you know, it is indeed amazing to see how they honor the mother's word, you know. Because when the mother said, whatever you have got, divide it among yourselves, that is what the Pandavas actually do. And it's great on the part of the Pandavas, on the part of Draupadi, who appreciates this sentiment and abides by it. That is the reason Draupadi becomes the wife to all of the Pandavas. And again, another interesting, very powerful and poignant point we have to note here is it is not like it was polygamy. Because, you know, even though the five brothers married Draupadi, they had a strict rule between themselves that in turns, 1 year, each brother would spend with Draupadi. And during that year when each brother is spending with Draupadi, the other brothers would be, you know, considering Draupadi like a sister possibly. And it is with this kind of sacred harmony that the brothers married Draupadi, it is after this that Draupadi also came to be known as Panchali.
Right. And of course, the story goes that, you know, she was very, very apprehensive about this idea. And it was again Krishna who came and told the very same thing, you know, in what we're talking about, Draupada. He says that, you know, I know what is your goal in life. I know what is your ultimate desire in life. I will ensure that you get that. But, you know, these things which you go through in life, you leave it. You know, you trust me, you take this upon. This will not bring dishonor to your name. That's what Krishna says. This will actually help you reach what you have come here for, your purpose of life. I think that is the thought with which, you know, Krishna inspires Draupadi to take on this all said and done unnatural marriage. And I think that is what we all need to take home as a message, really, you know, because we all only have desires. We don't know how to really get them done. Even the highest desire, you know, for probably for merger in Swami or liberation or whatever we call that. So it is best left to Swami, the methodology or the route by which we reach there. And that can be done only through surrender. And that the epitome of that surrender is the five brothers and Draupadi, right? And that is what is the basis of the entire Bhagavatam.
On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this session to a close. The next fortnight, of course, we will be dealing with other general themes. When we return to the Bhagavata Vahini in the fortnight after that, we will go into this discussion on the meeting, the first ever meeting between Nara and Narayana, between Krishna and Arjuna. We are very eager to go into that, and I'm sure all of you also are. With that, we bring this to a close, offering it at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. Dear listeners, you can write to us with your thoughts, your feelings, your feedback, anything that comes in your mind or heart. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. Now we will end this with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
तेरी शरण में आए हैं हम कृपा करो हे जीवन दाता तुम ही हो माता पिता तुम ही हो तुम ही हो बंधु भ्राता श्रद्धा भक्ति के फूल खिला दो महका दो जग सारा ज्ञान की ज्योति जले हृदय में दूर करो अंधियारा सियाराम राधे श्याम सियाराम तेरी शरण में आए हैं हम कृपा करो हे जीवन दाता तुम ही हो माता पिता तुम ही हो बंधु भ्राता श्रद्धा भक्ति के फूल खिला दो महका दो जग सारा ज्ञान की ज्योति जले हृदय में दूर करो अंधियारा सियाराम राधे श्याम सियाराम कर्म कांड हम कुछ ना जाने माने ना नियम कोई बस ये जाने तू चाहे जो जग में वैसा होई भूले भटके हम बन जा रे सच्ची राह दिखा दे पग पग बिगड़ी बात बना दे सिया राम राधे श्याम सिया राम मानव क्या है देवों ने भी तेरी महिमा गाई गीता वचन भी पूरा किया है रघुकुल रीत निभाई अहिल्या को भी तूने रामा श्राप मुक्त कर डाला मीरा का विष प्याला सिया राम राधे श्याम सिया राम जगत में हमने कितने रिश्ते नाते संजोए सुख के दिनों में साथ हंसे सब दुख में कोई ना रोए तुम बिन अब तो कोई नहीं है अपना प्रभु जी सहारा जो खिवैया बन जाओ तो नैया पाए किनारा सिया राम राधे श्याम सिया राम तेरी शरण में आए हैं हम कृपा करो हे जीवन दाता तुम्ही हो माता पिता तुम्ही हो बंधु भ्राता श्रद्धा भक्ति के फूल खिला दो महका दो जग सारा ज्ञान की ज्योति जले हृदय में दूर करो अंधियारा सियारा राधे श्याम सिया राम सिया राम 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 राधे श्याम राधे श्याम सिया राम राधे श्याम।